So this is interviewing Tor Hagfors on 3rd April 73 at Arecibo. Well, now, you told me earlier, but could you just briefly repeat it? You started off in Norway in 50, got your degree in 59.
Yes, I got my degree in 59, and I worked for the Ministry of Defense in Norway up until that time. And I got involved in radar astronomy and plasma physics, for that matter, when I went for a year's leave of absence to Stanford University, which I had visited before, and where I knew quite a few of the people. When I spent my year there, when I arrived at the university, I was looking around for something to do, and never ever thought of being a radar astronomer.
Your degree was in what field?
In applied physics. My thesis was on radio wave propagation in the Arctic, actually.
In the Arctic, huh?
Yeah. Ionospheric radio wave propagation by scattering, by meteor trails and so on. So when I came to Stanford University, I was looking around for something to do, and after a couple of weeks, it was pointed out to me by Professor Eschelman that they had a 150-foot antenna lying on Stanford land, ready to be erected and used for something, not terribly well known, and I was charged with the task of looking into various possibilities for the use of this antenna. So I started looking around for various uses, and one possible use was to apply it to one of the experiments that was going there at the time, using much less sophisticated antennas, namely a simple broadside array, in order to measure the cislunar medium by reflections from the moon.
Could be.
And this experiment was carried out by transmitting basically to continuous or semi-continuous waves at adjacent frequencies, close to the space frequencies, and measuring the phase of the beat coming back. Incidentally, I should point out to you that we only obtained moon echoes on 3 days. And you could only see the moon when you could sight the moon through one of the pipes in the broadside array, visually.
That was the criterion.
That was the criterion. We always got echoes when we could see the moon. Well, anyway.
What was the reason for this?
There was hardly any pointing system that worked at all.
Oh, this was your pointing?
Yeah, that
was
the
pointing.
You could never hit the moon without without that kind of
system. Who was doing this experiment?
The experiment was done by Bill Gallagher and Kay Howard, primarily. Bill, incidentally, was shortly after I left, was electrocuted in that transmitter. Well, anyway, I was studying this experiment, and it turned out that the reason why the results were so erratic was that the moon was a sufficiently spread target in depth, so that the phase of the modulation was jumping back and forth all the time, and the experiment was much more suitable for studying the properties of the scattering of the moon than it was to study the cislunar medium.
Right.
Well, once I realized that, I worked out a theory for translating the frequency correlation function to power delay relationships, and wrote reports and papers about this, how the moon could be mapped and how one could find the statistics of the slopes of the lunar surface, etc. by this technique.
And that was the first time that this technique had been thought of, mapping another planet.
Yeah,
that's in JGR, you said?
It was published in JGR in, I believe, 1960. and there are also some scientific reports on it. Now, of course, that was just one view of the 156 antenna. Excuse me. I was also involved in trying to use the antenna for diagnostic purposes in the ionosphere. There was at that time much talk about detecting free electrons in the ionosphere with extremely powerful radars. One can actually detect Thomson scattering from electrons in the ionosphere. And when I was there, some extremely puzzling results had come out for the first attempt by Ken Bowles in Illinois, I believe. Namely, that the frequency spread of the returns was much narrower than one would expect on the basis of the thermal motion of the electrons. And a large number of people like Thayer, Saltpeter, Farley, Doherty, and so on, were working on the problem trying to solve it. And I started working on the problem also. And of course, being a newcomer to the plasma field, I sort of lost out in the competition, and their preprints at least became available before I had my results out. But at least I was well on the way. So when it became apparent that the problem on the narrow spectrum, which was due to the coupling to the ion, basically, when that was solved, I started working on another problem, namely scattering from a magnetized plasma, which at least intuitively held great promise in that one would be able to see the ion gyrate around the magnetic field lines. So that many people were talking about using this technique as a mass spectrometer in the ionosphere, so that one could detect all the different ion gyrations and get all the ion masses out. And I did indeed work out the theory for this and publish the results, and I think that was the best one after it. But of course, there were many other people that published these results simultaneously, practically.
One question before we get too much further. Was the 150 foot the one that was doing this cislunar thing, or that was the array?
That was the broadside array, and the 150 foot antenna that I was trying to find some application for was never completed during the time I was there. They started putting it together, but it was still lying on its back on the ground when I left.
When did that get finished, you know?
It was probably finished in 62 or something like that.
And what did it work on?
This antenna is a large 150 foot antenna which can probably only be used up to approximately 200 megahertz, something like that. There was a similar antenna in Scotland at the time used for oil scatter experiments, something like that. This antenna in Stanford has been used to track space probes around Venus and so on in order to study their atmospheres.
Okay, well then back to you. Sorry to interrupt you. While I think of it, can I ask you another question about this business with Bay?
Yeah.
Could you just describe what you know about it again for me?
Well, I really know very little.
Really?
I've not seen any other publications, but I have had the publications described for me. And apparently what...
And do you know where they were? What journal?
No. I cannot remember.
But in the Hungarian language? Also, you know
that? I'm not sure. In any case, I would have seen a translation of it, of course. But the main feat in that was the construction of the integrator, which was an electrolytic integrator, so that by electrolysis, gas was developed wherever there was, at whichever range there was a signal present. And the range which corresponded to the proper echo was the range where most gas bubbles developed.
Right, so we had a series of test tubes.
A series of test tubes corresponding to different ranges, and it was shown that that tube which corresponded to the range of the moon was the one that
developed most. And this was approximately what year?
This must have been in either 1945 or 1946.
Right after the war?
Right after the war.
And you say you're in doubt as to whether it was he or the U.S. Signal Corps that made the first detection.
I really don't know the historical facts.
I'll have to check on this. Okay, back to you. So after this magnetosphere theory that you developed,
Well, after that, I returned to my home country and worked there for 2 years, and apparently several people got reasonably excited about what I'd done, and I was asked to return the reflector to MIT. MIT in particular at that time was quite strong in radar astronomy. They had people like Gordon Pettengill on the staff, and they also had John Evans, and they had several information theorists who were interested in coding schemes and so on, like Paul Lee and Bob Price and Kitchener. They were all interested in setting up a group for radio astronomy, centered at that time on the Millstone radar, which was operating at 400 megahertz, and which was later operated to 1300 megahertz.
And when did this begin?
It probably was built about 1956-57.
Oh, that early?
Yeah. But it was not built for radar astronomy purposes. It was built primarily for tracking of satellites.
I see.
So
when was it first used in radar astronomy?
It was used in radar astronomy at approximately 1960, maybe 61.
So you got there in what year?
I got there in 1963 and started working with the group, and gradually became quite heavily involved in lunar research by radar mapping of various kinds and trying to model the surface and try to speculate what kind of surface was there, whether there was dust, whether how many rocks were present on the surface per unit area, etc.
Using the theory which you originally developed.
Yes,
I used it,
but also I went into some theory of scattering from rough surfaces and so on. Did some work on that and did several experiments. And from there on we became gradually more and more involved in lunar research, and we acquired a contract with NASA, which was a joint contract between MIT and Cornell to do lunar research at a variety of wavelengths, at 3.8 centimeters using the Haystack radar, at 23 centimeters using the Millstone radar, which had then been upgraded, and at 70 centimeters using the Arecibo instrument. And we worked on that project for several years and produced a series of reports, and it resulted in quite sophisticated maps of the moon and some ideas about the density of the surface material and also rock densities and general nature of the surface.
Have these things been proven out, would you say, by the Apollo?
By and large they've been proven out. Of course, when you do radar work, you get statistical measures, and when you land, you only get a snapshot.
Yeah.
So you can't really say that it's exactly as we predicted, but by and large, I would say that they're proving quite reasonable.
And this work is published where in general?
Most of it has been published in JGR, some in Radio Science, and in various conference proceedings and so on. And we also started within that group writing a book on radar astronomy.
Right, I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, which was really had its origin in a course summer course we had in Calvin in the field.
I see. What other places, when you arrived at Millstone, what other places were doing lunar radar at that time in the world?
Yeah, JPL had also done some lunar radar, and Jovial Bank had also been in the field sometime.
NRL, we've already talked about.
Yes, right. NRL also. And I think that Stanford University, of course, also. But I think that was about it. I'm not aware of any Russian work on a lunar radar at all.
When did they first start, or have they yet?
They have. The Russians have never gotten off the ground really in high power radar astronomy. They have some work going on with Kosmonaut in order to measure the distance to Venus in particular, and to detect some of the other planets. But it looked to us in many cases very primitive, and they have not certainly not pursued it recently. And as a matter of fact, they have done some work, I believe, where they have Jovial Bank illuminate targets for them, and then just looked at them passively.
That's sort of the opposite of what Lovell usually does, feeling the Russian signals from their satellites. That's interesting. In return, it sends signals to the Russians. Well, so this work, this series of work on the lunar surface, this went into the mid-60s.
It went into, let's see, well, it really still goes on.
Yes.
It still goes on at MIT because there
Frank,
is now...
Stanzisky
is still working on it, and that is a direct continuation of that program.
Right.
Now, I left that program in 1966 to go to Peru and head up to the Camarca radio observatory.
Nothing about that.
Well, I have a picture of it on the wall up there. You would take a look at it afterwards. It is a large array. It is operating at 50 megahertz. It has 18,000 dipoles. It is a square, 300 by 300 meters, and unfortunately it's not steerable because it is made primarily for investigations of the ionosphere. Now, the reason why it was put there was to attempt to detect iron man. It would be used as a mass spectrometer, as I described.
Ionized in the ionosphere.
Mm-hmm. And it turns out that theory predicts that those lines can only be seen if you look extremely close perpendicular to the magnetic field. So, as a consequence, you had to pick a site near to the magnetic equator so that it could be perpendicular to the magnetic field at all altitudes. So this station was built by the Department of Commerce, by the National Bureau of Standards, the Boulder Labs.
Mm-hmm.
It started in the early 60s.
And what,
60, 61.
Could you spell that name, please?
Jicamarca. Jicamarca. It's an Indian name.
Jicamarca. And where can I get a description of this?
That observatory?
Yes.
Yes, there are some descriptions of it, and I can find you some descriptions.
Okay, fine.
So I worked there for 2 years, and...
The iron line was not found, I think.
No, I
haven't heard about it anyway.
Well, we did find hydrogen, indications of hydrogen lines, but the other ions were never found because of that fallacy in the prediction. What people had not accounted for was the diffusive interaction between charged particles when they travel over long distances, which, you see, the radius of gyration of of the ions is quite large. I mean, it's like many meters, maybe tens of meters.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the course of travel, going round as a big circle like that, the ion does not return to the point it originated. And when it does not, when it misses by something comparable to the wavelength, you don't see any lines anymore. And that apparently was what happened. And it was unfortunately a fallacy of the prediction.
But the hydrogen line still apparently was visible.
The hydrogen line is still, because the mass of the hydrogen is sufficiently small so that the circles are, you see, the gyro frequency is very, so it returns much more quickly. And you can see that. But O plus, for instance, nobody ever saw.
Hmm.
Although people still think that there ought to be a chance, but it has not materialized.
Is this array still in work?
It is still in operation, yes. It's still in operation.
What sort of work does it do now? Just regular ionospheric?
Ionospheric work, yes. It measures temperatures, densities, etc. Up to high altitude. Well, we shipped out already in 1969 because of political difficulties. Shortly after we arrived there was a revolution and the elected president was sent to Argentina in his dressing gown with his mistress. So he arrived in Argentina in slippers, I guess. And the military took over. And the military was extremely nationalistic. And they started picking on the U.S. concerns, such as the oil companies and so on, nationalized the oil companies and caused extremely strained relations between the U.S. and China.
What about the race to detect the first signal off Venus? You were not directly involved in that?
I was not directly involved in that. It took place in the early 60s between the various observatories, like the Morristown radar, the Millstone radar.
Morristown RCA.
RCA, yeah. Yeah. The Millstone radar. The Russian radar, that we don't know where it is. We don't even know which frequency they transmitted on, I guess. JPL was involved.
Okay, so I'll talk to some other people about that.
Yeah.
And that was around 1962?
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for the information.